Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in African American Studies. I am your host, Adam McNeil. Today, I talked to Dr. Kevin Dawson, Associate Professor of History at the University of California, Merced. Dr. Dawson is here to discuss his newly published work, Undercurrents of Power, Aquatic Culture, and the African Diaspora, published by our friends at Penn Press. Welcome to the show, Dr. Dawson. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's been a pleasure reading your work. As a Floridian, as someone who grew up, near the water, it was really interesting learning about, African diaspora, aquatic culture, and pilots, and all the things I love talking about. So, just an exciting opportunity to chat with you today about your work.
Yeah, glad I can participate.
Most definitely. And so to start off, what motivated you to write Undercurrents of Power?
I think a lot of it was my experience. I mean, kind of like you, I grew up near the ocean, although in Southern California, in LA County, South LA County. And I grew up swimming, learned to swim when I was a few months old, started surfing when I was maybe 8 or 9. And realized that there were, at the same time that I was engaging in these aquatic activities, I realized that there were these perceptions both within the African-American community and within the larger kind of American or white communities that Black people don't swim. As I got into college, I started seeing accounts, even as an undergrad history major, of slaves and Africans swimming, canoeing, diving underwater, and these sorts of things. And I realized that they kind of cut across these grains of popular assumption. And so that really kind of drew me in to think more deeply about the aquatic past of African and African descended peoples.
And that made me think a lot about when I was preparing for the interview, just really thinking about what does it take for a historian to write a book like this, right? What methods, but also what kind of archives are you engaging in? And also to, talk about the African diaspora, I'm sure you have to know, the various groups of Africans that were over there prior to them being taken captive and brought to the Americas. So can you talk to us about that process of how you got to really learn about the different ethnic groups and such, so that you can, really hone in on this, bit about aquatic culture?
Yeah. So I think that's a really important point. I mean, one of the things that really helped me was, as an undergrad, I think one of the best bits of advice I ever got from a professor was that as you're studying an area, think about you know, pick at least, or as you're preparing for kind of a job in academia, a job as a historian, think about where you like to travel or where you'd want to travel to. And so have at least one subfield in that area. And so growing up along the ocean, enjoying beaches and warm tropical places, I picked the Caribbean and I picked West Africa, or more specifically, more broadly, Atlantic Africa. And so I ended up actually as an undergrad going there. I applied for a fellowship, got $1,000, I think it was, and went to Senegal. The first time it was Senegal, the Ivory Coast, and mainly Ghana. And that really kind of opened my eyes to African maritime experiences, African beach culture, learning about different ethnic groups kind of firsthand rather than just reading about them in books. And so that really was eye-opening and kind of helping me to dive into the topic. As far as kind of the broader structural methods and things, I mean, people ask me all the time, like, what kind of a historian are you? Like, are you a social historian, a cultural historian, a Marxian? I mean, they try and even narrow it down more than that. I guess what my answer to be would be that I'm a historian of the African diaspora first and foremost, and I'll go wherever I need to, borrow from whatever methodologies I need to. And so I guess what I would say is the really important point for me is to be creative. To not kind of confine myself and my scholarly inquiry to any particular kind of methodological approach. But in my case, I mean, I've been around the world doing research and people often say, well, you know, how are you justifying going to Italy or wherever, to England, to Hawaii to do research? And my answer is I study two things. I study the ocean and African descended people. And wherever there's the two, that's where I'll go. And so I think we have to kind of break down these traditional, in order to write this book anyway, I needed to shatter these kind of traditional temporal frameworks that oftentimes bound history and also geographic boundaries and to be creative in how I'm going to chase down sources and how I'm going to use sources.
And let me tell you, as a graduate student who, you know, PhD student about to start in, like I said before, like, you know, next month, hearing this bit about creativity is piquing my interest and makes me want to just talk to you about that for the whole, you know, for the whole period of our conversation. But no, we're going to stay on this book, right? We'll have other conversations in other venues. So with that, it is me is excited to hear all this. One of the bits that I most appreciated about your book, especially in line with the comments that you just made, is really thinking about how the aquatic and the maritime is interconnected and related to so many other bits too, especially when it comes to bits about, you know, maritime slavery. And so can you talk to us a bit about, you know, and kind of switching gears just slightly, can you talk to us a bit about, you know, what made maritime slavery versus, you know, I would say talking about breaking down, you know, barriers of what people typically think versus, you know, this typical plantation slavery image that most of our listeners probably have in their head. Can you speak to that particular difference with some of the folks in your book?
Yeah. So I think you're striking at kind of the heart of what I'm getting at is that there's not, I mean, we oftentimes, when we think about maritime history, we think of it as being something very different than kind of, or maritime experiences being something very different than kind of terrestrial or land-bound experiences, that people are either like sailors or farmers or something like that, that there's these kind of discrete spheres that people circulated and operated in. And I think my research shows that that's not true, whether it's in Africa or in the Americas. And so if you think about plantation slavery, yeah, most slaves, you know, they're working as agricultural hands. I mean, most of the wealth that was generated by slavery was produced through agricultural labor. But at the same time, most plantations were built near waterways, navigable waterways, for a few reasons. One is that it facilitated kind of watering crops if they were going to create irrigation systems. It did that. But it also, and more importantly, it facilitated the shipment of goods from the plantation to markets. And so you had these waterways that then allowed enslaved people to swim and to canoe. And importantly, I think the geography, when we think about the American South, the geography of the American South and the climate of the American South much more closely resembles Africa than it does Europe, where you have these broad, kind of sluggish rivers that are ideal for swimming and for canoeing and fishing and things like that. And so when enslaved people arrived in the Americas, they found an environment that, in many ways it was different. But then it also, I would imagine, and sources suggest, had these kind of echoes of familiarity. And this allowed them to recreate and to reimagine aquatic traditions, even as they were working as agricultural field hands. And so they're using their traditions to help provide a sense of cultural continuity from the communities they were taken from, and to really make their lives better, to provide, you know, their fishing, to augment the rations that their owners gave them. They're using canoes to go to markets to sell goods, to make their lives a little bit more comfortable and bearable. And they're swimming and boating to go visit family members and friends who are living on adjacent slave holdings. They were able to use water again, I think, in many of the same ways that they had used it in Africa.
And it's really interesting too, especially on that last part about, you know, uses in Africa and uses in the Americas, especially when it comes to canoes. And you talked about this a lot, about the canoe making. I feel like if we pull most Americans and ask them who were the founders of, you know, canoe culture, I guess, in what is now the United States, right? Probably won't be African descended people, but you have a little bit to say about that. Can you speak on that?
Yeah, and I think that's you have some really insightful questions. I mean, that's a really, I think, important thing. And I spent a lot of time thinking about that, a lot of time talking to maritime historians, to Jeff Bolster and others, not just maritime historians, but actual people who sailed and who are familiar with boat making and ship making processes. Because, I mean, one of the things I think we need to think about is, like, what is a canoe? What does a canoe look like? And so for most Americans, I mean, you're younger than I am, Adam, but most people who were kind of, came of age in maybe the 70s or 80s or before then, for us, a canoe, if we are familiar with a canoe, it was these metal or kind of aluminum canoes that are modeled after a Native American birch bark canoe, the design. And so when we think canoe, we think that design. And so we wouldn't think of a dugout canoe. And also a lot of kind of previous scholars, I mean, one thing I think that's important is that a lot of previous scholars and then also the former slave owners and children of enslavers who wrote these kind of apologetic histories of slavery, if you will, right after the Civil War, they made it a point to minimalize African wisdom, African contributions to American society. And so they would have us believe that Africans who came from iron-making societies, iron-using societies that made and used iron tools, then arrived in the Americas and adopted Native American techniques. And African techniques using iron tools, you could construct a dugout canoe in a week or so, but using traditional indigenous techniques, it could take you upwards of a year. And so it didn't really make sense that Africans would adopt Native American techniques. And so what I first started to do, I mean, if we're going to really kind of unpack this, is I started to look at the canoe hulls, like go around the East Coast primarily, and look at canoe hull, the hulls of dugout canoes to see if I could tell what kind of tool marks were on those canoes, because you can see chisel marks. And so I was trying to determine if they were made by a stone tool or by an iron tool. I usually couldn't tell, and I didn't really even know how I'd be able to tell, because they were so worn and things like that. But what I noticed was the design of the canoe, and that there were two very different designs. One that looked very much like the African dugout canoes I had seen, primarily in, by this time, the Ivory Coast, Ghana, Togo, Benin, Nigeria, and to a lesser extent, Senegal. I mean, they have a different model of dugout canoe, but these canoes, they either look like that, or they looked like, and what I came to understand was an indigenous or Native American dugout canoe design. And so paying attention to that kind of material culture is what really helped me to understand that there were these two different canoe cultures, if you will, in America. And so, I mean, I know I probably digressed there a little bit, but yeah, that's how I think I got to this. Or how I would say we need to rethink kind of what is canoe culture in America.
That was perfect, because and you invoked the name of Bolster too, Dr. W. Jeffrey Bolster. And excuse me, I remember I took an American Revolution seminar in my master's program at Simmons University, Boston, Massachusetts. And I remember reading, or I don't know how it came to it, but it came to blackjacks. And I was like, whoa, this is cool, because I hadn't had a topic to write about. And really, I just went down, you know, I just like did my best to immerse myself in like a couple weeks of, you know, black sailors, pilots and such during the time of the American Revolution, and end up reading Bolster's text. And, you know, he talks, you know, he in portions of the book talks about his own experiences as someone who's, you know, not only a maritime historian, but someone who has actually, you know, been a mariner. And so I think that, you know, do you think that as someone who's writing this bit of history, that for you to be able to know as much as you can, you have to maybe not even operate, but you have to know you have to really know the inner workings of all of these different canoe bits and all of the different forms of I don't want to say bow making, because that's larger than that, but you know, vessels, I guess, might be a word that I would just use for the time being.
Yeah, I think you raise a really important point. Again, is that you need to really, I think it's not enough for historians, like as we're pushing boundaries, trying to understand, the experiences of dispossessed, marginalized, relegated people. We need to push the boundaries. We need to get outside of our. I mean, for me, it wasn't necessarily getting outside of my comfort zone, because these were things that I love to do. But if you're interested in, say, maritime history, try and find a way to, I would say, immerse yourself in maritime history or in your topic, so you understand, so you have like a technical understanding of the process of it, right? So I say this because I've read other historians who are doing maritime history, and they'll make false assumptions, and I know, like right off the top, I know that it's because they don't have the kind of technical understanding of boat making, of underwater diving, of surfing, of even swimming or snorkeling. And so it leads them to some false conclusions. And so I think it's really important that no matter what the topic is that we understand it, you know, and it can be a really fun and rewarding way to understand history, right? I mean, if you're going to be a food historian, you're going to eat a lot of different types of food. And so I think the same thing when we're understanding these other aspects of history, we need to actually engage in it and have some kind of firsthand knowledge of it rather than just relying on archives, on published sources or interviews even. Don't just rely on interviews, but try and actually, get in the water, have that experience.
And it's really interesting because, just thinking about, the different levels of immersion and considering, this is about aquatic culture, right? It adds that other layer of immersion that you need to do, not only in the work, but also in the water in and of itself, which, just goes into, the mode of how important and how powerful the aquatic culture is. But then, one of the other parts about your book that was interesting, you also talk a little bit about music too, which I thought was like, that was surprising. So can you talk a little bit about the musical folkways that you engage in the book too, or engage with?
Yeah. So, I'll come to that in just a second, but you said, and I think again, you picked up on this, like the use of aquatic. And so I think that's really deliberate. For me, it was really deliberate rather than, for a long time, when I was writing the book, I was using maritime. But again, when we think about maritime history, we tend to think of it as one particular thing, as ships and harbors, something that occurred on European, if you're talking about the early modern period, on these wooden ships and on docks. And so I use aquatic to stress that, yeah, this is maritime history, but it's a very different type of maritime history. It's, as you said, it's an immersory history. It's people engaging in water or with water in very different ways than we traditionally think of when we're kind of talking about maritime history. And so I think that's an important point to get to. And then the music aspect of it, that's, I think, really important because when we're recreating the lived experience of people, having been on, spent time on wooden ships, both on the West Coast and the East Coast sailing, and then having spent time in African dugout canoes, I realized, you realize instantly that maritime history that you can't think of when you're trying to recreate and reimagine the experiences of enslaved people, you want to provide, I wanted to provide a really full kind of, variegated examination of all of the aspects of life. And so it's not just visual, right? It's not just what they're seeing, but it's also what they're tasting. So as you're diving underwater, what does the water taste like? As spray is hitting you, whether you're in a canoe or a ship, what does that spray coming off the water taste like? And what does it sound like on the water? And so those sounds in some ways can be very different than kind of land-based sounds, but then they can also be very similar. And so that's what I was trying to get into that last chapter of my book, is that, Africans had this rich tradition of call and response songs, of paddling songs, and that they're similar to the songs that enslaved field hands sang, but that they could also be quite different in what they're singing about, and how the songs are used, not just the words of the songs, but the tempo of the song is used to control, to slow down the paddling rhythm to something that's manageable for enslaved people, right? It becomes this way of resistance. So while slave owners want slaves to paddle as fast as possible, slaves are going to sing a song that gives them a manageable work skill so they can work at a rhythm that's, acceptable for them and manageable for them. And so, I mean, I think that's another thing to think about as, and one of my mentors in at the University of South Carolina, Mark Smith, a really creative, imaginative guy. He got me into the sound history, where he has this book out, and an article, but the book is Listening to American History. So what does slavery sound like? What's the crack of a whip? What's the rattling of chains sound like? And so after reading that book as a grad student, then I thought, well, what does maritime history sound like? And so that chapter allowed me to bring in some of the sounds of maritime slavery.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And it's interesting because then the next part for me is, right, you talk about Dr. Smith with that and how he, you know, was very instrumental in bringing this particular different, very, very different and very sensory bit of history that you're engaging with. And so how does this very deliberate use of aquatic culture and all of the different ways that you unravel it in your book, how does that seep into your work as a teacher and as a professor, as you create your classes? And are you also incorporating kind of like this bit of kind of like, you know, what does maritime slavery sound like? What does, you know, these different areas of the African diaspora, what does that sound like? How does that inform your work as a teacher?
Yeah, it's challenging, I think, to teach your own work. I mean, it can be in some ways really easy, but it's challenging, I guess, to assign my work and have students read it. So for me, if I assign my work, I tend to do it in two ways. One, I try and make it anonymous. So white out my name so undergrads don't know. They typically figure it out though, that I'm the one who wrote it. And so what I also do is I assign the primary sources. So I'll assign, you know, an article, a chapter, or whatever, something that I wrote, and then assign some of the primary sources to get them to talk, because they typically won't just talk if it's just about like my article. They feel, I guess, intimidated. I guess what I do is I use it to try and get them to challenge kind of their common assumptions of human experiences. Because they'll oftentimes think that, you know, listening. So if you're, say, listening to the past or tasting the past, they oftentimes don't think about, well, look, that's exactly how my daily life operates. You know, I'm listening to all these things and that's informing how I'm perceiving my surroundings. I'm smelling, you know, my environment. So all of these sensory types of things, I'm touching my environment, or, you know, the heat or the cold is informing how I'm perceiving my environment. And so I very much try and get students to think of it in those ways as well, not just visual history, but bringing in all of these sensory aspects of it to understand the past and also to be kind of critical scholars to think, because sometimes you might see one thing, and smell something else, or see one thing and hear something very different, and the two aren't necessarily in concert or aren't necessarily agreeing with each other. And so how then do you make sense of this when your sensory experiences are telling you different things? And so that's what, yeah. So, I mean, I guess that's how I'm using these sources, and sound and touch and smell, in my classroom.
Very, very interesting. Very, very interesting. And one of the last questions that I'll ask you too, was one that I had was thinking about in the context of kind of like, what are the norms of American culture, and then made me think about it in the context of your book. So how are women are not typically seen within aquatic culture as far as, as dominant figures, right? I'm not making a huge leap there, but how do you engage with it as far as, right, mm-hmm. in within the African diaspora, where are women of central, are they central figures as far as divers, as far as, you know, the canoe culture and you know, the various bits that you bring up in your book? How are women engaged with as far as like their importance in the story of aquatic culture in the African diaspora?
Yeah, and that's I think a really important point for students to think about as and professors as well to think about as we're kind of crafting our stories, is because they're not really visible in most of the sources. They're not featured first and foremost. And so how do you give them a voice? And so one of the things that I saw was that in Africa, I mean, at least travelers to Western travelers, white travelers to Africa, would document some of the activities that women were engaging in. They document them swimming, diving underwater, diving to great depths, that they're really strong swimmers, that they're taking canoes to market and selling goods. And I mean, again, traveling to Africa, I saw women paddling canoes or using outboard motors on dugout canoes and using those to go to market. And so I understood that, yeah, they're engaged in these activities. But then in the Western context, I mean, it's bad luck to have a woman aboard ship. And it's problematic to have, naked women diving for pearls, or at least from the Western context of diving for pearls or salvage diving, because again, they're going to bring bad luck if they're on a ship. And then they're distracting to all these men. And so, you know, how do you bring them into the story? And so I really struggled and made a conscious effort to do it. And I was, especially in the Americas. And so I was able to find several accounts of women using swimming to resist being raped by enslavers or by kind of random white travelers traversing plantation landscapes. They'll swim out to a river and a white man couldn't swim after them. And so they could just sit there and then oftentimes make fun of these would-be rapists who are just, 30 feet away from them. But also, I think looking at how their methods for using canoes, because you do see women when people are running away, you see women in canoes. So they're paddling from island to island. And so this clearly indicates that they would have, in the Caribbean, I should say, they're paddling from island to island, which clearly indicates that they were really capable canoeists. Not only did they have the physical strength to paddle, but they also understood the currents and the wind patterns, which is important because if you just try to paddle like the most direct route, you could actually be swept off course by these cross currents and taken out into this big kind of empty expanses that are in the Caribbean. And so they had to understand these wind patterns and currents. But then also really how they're using, and what I found the most fascinating was how women used canoes to get the commodities that enslaved people produced in their free time, the fish, the fresh produce, the crafts, how they use that to get to, how they use canoes to get these items to markets. And it's not just that they're going into markets by themselves, but that they're bringing their children with them. And so now you have canoes basically functioning as the family car. And as they're paddling to market, you get many women joining up together. And it's not just paddling kind of silently as we do when we're driving in cars, but they're able to talk to each other. And I speculate that they're fixing prices. I mean, one of the complaints of urban white residents was that slaves, enslaved vendors were engaging in price fixing and price gouging. And paddling to market provided really the ideal, I argue, opportunity to say, all right, what are you selling? Okay, let's set this price for, you know, for this vegetable or for fish, you know, and engage in these kind of price setting schemes that benefited them rather than kind of putting all of these enslaved female vendors in competition with each other. They're actually working in concert. And so, I mean, it again, I think it lets us creatively think about, use sources to think about how people lived their lives and how they pushed back against their own subjugation.
And it's so fascinating, because then I think a lot about, I really think a lot about how, you know, we look at, you know, bits of resistance too, and maritime resistance and water resistance as well. And so it's just really, just overall, your book was just fascinating, and I'm so glad I actually came across it through. You were featured. I think it was either a book review or an interview that you had with the African American Intellectual History Society's Black Perspectives blog, and I was just reading like the prose and such. I was like, oh shoot, this book.
Yeah.
Shoot, let me hit up a Pen Press real quick and see if I can get a copy, because I need this in more ways than one. Because you know, I'm a Black kid who grew up not swimming, and like I've lost, you know, friends, mm-hmm, to, you know, drowning back home in Florida, and you know, and you know, I live you know in Florida, and so the first, I worked for the National Park Service in the summertime, and the first place I went to was Casilla de San Marcos in St. Augustine. And in the 1960s, there was a famous time where you have that famous picture of the guy throwing bleach in the pool because, you know, there were Black people in the pool. And so, you know, I think about like how all this connects to, you know, my particular life, and then my family being from the Sea, mm-hmm, Islands in South Carolina. And so it's just like reading your book to me brought so much joy, but also brought me into really thinking, as you were just saying before, how to think creatively about history. And especially in light of, right, we're days away from the sixth, you know, August 20th of 1619, particular, you know, pin date that, you know, it's very big this week. A lot of interesting articles being written about, you know, 1619 and projects being made about it too. And I really think that your book is, mm-hmm, should be a part of these conversations, because it's, you know, we're talking about something that has particular implications on literal life and death in many ways. And it should be taken seriously, I think, in part based upon that reason for alone.
Yeah. And to elaborate, and I mean, I think also it's important for us as historians to think about how our scholarship can have these positive impacts on present circumstances, how our history can help to right historical wrongs. And so what I mean by that is that I've actually gotten involved in a lot of in a number of projects that are designed to teach Black youth. I mean, primarily they were designed to teach Black youth, but then also brown youth as well, Latinos, American Indians, how to swim, because there's a disproportionately high rate of drowning among African Americans. I mean, it depends kind of age, but if you take like Black youth, they're like six times more likely to drown than white youth. And I actually, I mean, I So what I do is I go out and I talk to different organizations that are promoting swimming to try and dispel the myths that swimming is an un-Black activity, to try and encourage people to take pride in their African cultural heritage by swimming, and also by extension by surfing, by underwater diving. And so I mean I can't take credit for being creative in that, because actually what I did is I wrote, after writing my article Enslaved Swimmers and Divers in the Atlantic World in it was 2005, it came out in Journal of American History. You know, I wrote it, and I think like most historians, I thought, okay, historians are going to read it. And then about a year later, Bruce Weigel from the International Swimming Hall of Fame down in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, sent me this email, and he was super excited about my scholarship and wanted to talk to me. And brought me in and got me involved in it. And so I've done, these go around mostly to the East Coast, but then also some other places out west, and give talks on, you know, how we can use our understanding of our historical understanding to promote swimming today. And so, yeah, I mean, I think as historians, as we're kind of rewriting history or writing more inclusive histories, we should also think about how our histories are informed by or can inform modern circumstances.
Most definitely. And you kind of broached this a little bit, and this would be our final question about the book and its processes. How has Undercurrents of Power, Aquatic Culture in the African Diaspora, how has the book affected you, right? How have you, do you think that you have changed because of this book?
I mean, I think writing any sort of history is going to change you. I mean, it forces you to be more, I think if you're a conscious historian, a conscious scholar, as you're writing scholarship, you're thinking about your relationship with the topic. And so it has, it's changed me a lot. And I think it would be hard to, I mean, that's a provocative question to kind of say, well, it's changed me in these particular ways, but it's definitely forced me to be a really creative, and thoughtful, I think a more creative and more thoughtful person. Because I mean, one of the challenges in writing this book was that, at least from my perspective, the way that I see plantation slavery and colonization is that it's the destruction of two societies and two peoples, right? I mean, you have to displace native peoples in order to make space for enslaved Africans. And so you have both of these groups of people who have been tragically impacted by slavery. And so I didn't want my history to also kind of perpetuate those wrongs. And also, I mean, I am part Choctaw and part Black. And so this was always something that was conscious in my mind. And so I wanted to make sure that as I was writing about how Africans were, as I argue anyway, kind of layering African meanings, African spirituality onto waterways that had once had Native American meanings and spirituality, that I was also being respectful of indigenous people. And so I think that's something that really, I mean, it forced me to kind of think about my own identity and how my identity was shaping the book. And so one thing, I mean, I could have done, for example, when I was writing, I mean, to circle back a little bit, when I was writing about how Africans made dugout canoes, and how they refused to use indigenous techniques, I tried to be, I mean, a conscious effort not to minimalize indigenous maritime techniques. I mean, because they had And there's a number of really provocative books that have come out on in the past year or two on Native American, 2 or 3 years, I should say, Native American maritime history. And while a lot of the previous scholarship has really minimalized Native American techniques, I mean, this scholarship has really showed that, no, it was super advanced. Even if they're working with stone tools, it was super advanced. And so and this might be more than you wanted, but I mean, in celebrating African-American traditions, I wanted to make sure that I wasn't denigrating Native American traditions.
No, and that was actually like totally perfect, and it hit all of my all the places I wanted to go, because I forgot to ask you about the challenge question. And looky there, you're already, you know, we're at eye level. You already knew I was gonna ask a telepathic man. I love it. And really for me, like I said, your book means a lot for so many different reasons. And it's why I've been just so blessed and honored to have had you on the program. And you know, one of the actual last thing I ask you is, what is next for you? Right? Are you working on anything else? When can we expect potentially to have you, Dr. Kevin Dawson, back on New Books in African American Studies?
So right now I'm actually working on a few articles that are kind of related. I mean, I've been blessed that as people have read the book, they've asked me then to contribute book chapters and articles to special editions of journals. And so that set back the next book, I think, a little bit. But it's also given me a lot of opportunities to think about different, you know, to think about the project in different ways. I mean, one of the things that I'm going to come back to, I touch a little bit on it in this book, but is kind of a, instead of like a farm to table book, it's going to be a water to table book, where I'm looking, because my dissertation I looked at, fishing, fishing techniques, and food ways, and how enslaved people were able to use dugout canoes and their swimming skills to fish for food, or to catch shellfish, finned fish, things that we wouldn't consider seafood, like manatee, alligators, sea turtles, and how they used all of that to recreate African dishes in the Americas. And then how their enslavers came to be fond of this African cuisine. And so the next book is going to look at that. You know, just these African techniques that are used to catch seafood, and then the production of seafood, and how African informed cuisine then influenced American, and I might also look at English, or at least I'm going to look at the Caribbean, English Caribbean, but cuisine as well.
Exciting and totally perfect timing, because last night I'm cleaning up my apartment before I move out of North Carolina for New Jersey, and to have something in the background, I listened to this great podcast called The Nod, and they had Michael Twitty, the author of The Cooking Gene, on, and he, you know, he talked about his work as a culinary historian and such, and so, you know, he's, you know, work, he's making food that enslaved cooks would have made, right, with all of the processes and procedures, right? And so, you know, I'm you know, listening to that like late last night, earlier this morning, so to hear you from sea to table, from water to table, like that was like whoa, man, this is some psychedelic super awesome kind of stuff, man. Like wow. And I'm sure the folks that are listening to this are going to be like, "Well, doggone, Dr. Dawson," or as you would say, "Kevin, man, You're some kind of guy.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, man. No worries.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I think too. The thing is we got to look for ways to find fun, to find some pleasure in. Because studying slavery can be hard and can be oppressive, right? I mean, or feel oppressive. I mean, it can be it can take a mental toll, and so trying to find, you know, some way of extracting something pleasurable out of it. I think that's another really important lesson for students is to go with a topic you like. And also, I mean, there's a lot of great stuff on pain and suffering and violence scholarship right now, but you know, you gotta, I think also find some solace, or, you know, in your scholarship. Otherwise it can just get too dark and grim.
Very much so. Very much so. And so, you know, once again, thank you so much for coming on and also providing that bit to graduate students where, hey, if you like a place, maybe try to find a way to get there with your scholarship. You know, because fellowships can bring you to somewhere like England, or, you know, could take you to Sierra Leone, or I don't know, Australia, who knows. But great bit of advice. And I will be taking notes as I listen back to this interview once it's published. And once again, folks, we have had the blessing and the honor to discuss with Dr. Kevin Dawson, Undercurrents of Power, Aquatic Culture in the African Diaspora. And I am your host, Adam McNeil, and it has been a pleasure once again to discuss another amazing book to add to our archive. And hey, if you like this discussion, if you like our other ones in our long, long archive, over a decade long, well, rate us, review us, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And hey, you know, drop us a line and let us know how we're doing too, because it's always good to get feedback from our listening audience. And so once again, folks, I'm Adam McNeil, your host, PhD student at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. And we have been on with Dr. Kevin Dawson with this amazing book. Please go get it. Pen Press. Go get it. Go get it. Go get it. Because you will not be disappointed. Just like I wasn't, for sure. And the rest of the world as well. And so, not to belabor the point, go out and get the book, engage with the work, and let us know how we're doing, and also let the authors know how they're doing as well, too. And so, once again, I'm Adam McNeil, your host from New Books in African American Studies. Over and out.